This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen to, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you for the next hour. And as always, you are listening to this program live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the program, and you're doing that through our HRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, this is going to be a fun show. Since 2004, today's guest has saddled 724 winners, which includes a couple of very talented greatest stakes winners, which you'll hear more about later in the program. And to say that the Chicago native has always had racing in his blood really wouldn't be all that accurate. He didn't grow up in a racing family, and he only found his way to the racetrack in 1983 thanks to his brother-in-law, who asked him to tag along when he went to work at Arlington Park. And since that day, it is something that has just gotten into his blood, and he is with me now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Please join me in welcoming trainer Brian Williamson to the program here today. Brian, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, for a guy that didn't grow up in a racing family, you've had an awful lot of success in your career.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. I've worked for some good people and learned, you know, got to learn some little things from each one, and I'm still going. So,
yeah, still going and still going strong. You're now, of course, I mentioned that you're a native of Chicago, but you're now based in Kentucky. Is that right?
Yes. We actually just bought a house in Louisville last year. And the Chicago racing's kind of the purses started going down, and then there was less racing, and Kentucky seemed to be going real good. So, and I had some success shipping in over the years to Kentucky tracks, and so we decided to take a shot and just go in that market.
Well, let's rewind this back to the beginning. How did you first get introduced to the sport of thoroughbred racing? Was it through your brother-in-law that day?
Yes, it was. Yes, I wasn't working. I had just got laid off from some job. I was just out of high school, and so I went out to. It was actually Balmoral Park in 1983, and I started working for trainer Merrill Scherer there, and that's kind of how it happened. Now I did go to the Balmoral meet, which lasted through the summer, and then I did get a job offer outside the track, and I went back, and I quit the racetrack and tried that other job. It was a pretty good job, but I had that horse racing in my blood and I couldn't stop thinking about it, and I just kept checking the newspapers every day, results and entries and stuff like that. And after a few weeks, I gave my notice and just went back to the track, and been here ever since.
Would you follow the sport even before you were formally introduced to it and started working for Merrill?
I just Kentucky Derby and stuff, and mostly the big races. I just kind of follow, and uh, And then, well, once I started working with them, it was just something about it gets in your blood. And it's just, it's exciting. I mean, but I will say the highs are high and the lows are low. But it's worth it, I think.
For people that aren't familiar with Balmoral Park, tell me a little bit more about that racetrack.
It's in the south suburbs of Chicago. It's pretty far south, but it is still considered a south suburb down there, I believe. And they had a bull ring for a while. I think it was a 5/8 track for a while, and then they expanded the track and made it like it. For a while there, I think it was the longest stretch in North America for a little bit, if I'm correct. If not, it was one of them. And then something happened. There was some, I'm not quite sure what happened, but then they ended up closing down, and it was a shame. It was awful far south from Chicago, so I'm not sure if they weren't getting the people, as many people as they thought they should. And then they had Sportsman Park going, and Hawthorne was going, and Arlington was going. And they were running pretty much the same time as Arlington, Balmoral was. So it was hard. It was kind of tough on them. Arlington would get the better horses. But Balmoral was still like a fun, like fair type atmosphere meet. But it was fun. But it was more like a fair type.
Arlington to this day is still one of the most beautiful racetracks that I've had the privilege to visit, and we've been to most of them, if not all of them, around the United States. And Arlington is just so pretty, and it's heartbreaking to see what's happening with the racing industry in Illinois.
Yes, I mean, you could go to all around any racetrack, and everybody there just, you know, raves about how beautiful it is, and it's a great turf course, it's a shame. You know, I think it's part politics and part everything else that just kind of happened to it. I know the state of Illinois was kind of gotten a deficit, and then the taxes started going up and everything else, and it just didn't go the right way, unfortunately. But they're supposed to open up back up and run coming up here, but that was kind of a last minute thing. I don't know if they'll struggle to get horses or not, because mostly everybody's committed to somewhere else by now. But it's been a strange year for sure.
No doubt about it. Yeah, to say the least is right. Talking with trainer Brian Williamson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Did you grow up on the north side or the south side of Chicago?
I was south side, so I was a White Sox fan. not a Cubs fan, but I was south side. And it was fun, and Sportsman's Park was real fun too. That track, it's a shame that track closed.
Did you go to many White Sox games?
Hawthorne's, you know, they got a good surface over there and stuff, so they're supposed to get the casino, so hopefully in a year or two they'll be going along a little better. The purses will get better, hopefully.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see. Did you go to many White Sox games when you were growing up?
Yes, I did go to quite a few, and I actually went to when they won the World Series in 85, was it? I did go to a game, the second game, and they beat the Houston Astros, and they went on to sweep and win the World Series. So I got to go to one of them games. It was awesome. It was just the atmosphere was electrical. You know, it was just like awesome. That was a big. That was one of my best memories for sure.
Oh, I'm sure it was. Did you have a favorite White Sox player or two?
I liked that whole team that year. They had Pierzynski. I never liked him when he didn't play for us. Once he started playing for us, the catcher there, he was you liked him when he was on your side. And they had a bunch of guys, you know, just I liked them all, really. And I don't know if payroll or whatever had something to do with it, but they kind of changed the team after that, and it didn't work out. So,
how about the Bears? Were you a big Bears fan too?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think everybody in Chicago is a big Bears fan, and that was another great great year when they won the Super Bowl. And it just so happened, Arlington burned down, and I went out to I could have went to Hawthorne because they switched the meet over there, but instead I went out to Parks, which was Phil. I wasn't named Philadelphia Park then, but anyways, I went there and then went to that meet and then shipped around to Delaware, to Monmouth, to the Meadowlands, and I was just grooming them. But I remember I was so mad because finally the Bears were good, and I was stuck out of town where sometimes they weren't showing the games back then. You know, you didn't have all this satellite and all this other stuff. I was kind of mad because I missed a bunch of games that year, but they ended up winning the Super Bowl, and that was great.
Yeah, wonderful memories. And you talked about before you got into racing, you would watch the Kentucky Derby and maybe a big race that was on TV. Do you remember your earliest Derby memories, some of the races that stood out to you, and you said maybe someday I might want to get involved in this sport?
I guess it was mostly, I can't remember too much about that as far as the names of the horses. I remember, you know, you'd root for something, but I remember when John Henry, you know, that really got me going, to John Henry and the Bart and stuff in the Million. And that was really exciting, especially around the Chicago area. The Million was something else that you get, you know, and it was, you can go see and everything else. And they, you know, John Henry was a legend, you know, the racehorse. So,
were you at the races that day?
No, I wasn't. I wish I was, no, I didn't get to that one, or them two or whatever. But I remember always like just rooting and watching the TV. I was a big John Henry fan.
Yeah, he was a special horse and easy to root for and easy to fall in love with for sure. So you start working with Merrill Scherer, and then where did you go from there?
Then I went to work for Eddie Reynolds. Well, actually, with Merrill, we went to Ohio for a little while, and it was Beulah, but it was named Darby Downs that year or something. And then I went to work for Eddie Reynolds. And then I went to work for John Palmer. Just people were leaving town and stuff, and I wanted to stick around so I could go to work for somebody else. It wasn't like I was just like trying to stay in Chicago. And then John Palmer, who had horses for John Franks when he was real big, the Louisiana guy. So I went to work for him, and then I went to I was working for Mike Wiseman, who was an old Chicago trainer, an ex-jockey, when Arlington burned down in 85. And then I went to work for John Palmer, who had John Franks' horses. And then I went to work for Joe Kaspersky after John Palmer left. I went back to Louisiana, and then I started working for my father-in-law, Harvey Veneer. And I tried to learn a little bit from everybody, and I pretty much slept eight and everything just horses, you know. I was just, you know, I usually get a room on the backside and just be at the barn pretty much all day. And then I met my wife at the trailer park in Arlington Park, and I think that was it was either 87 or 88, and we started dating, and then we eventually got married, and we were married 91, so it's going to be 29 years in August, so we're getting close. Wow. To
yeah, Brian, you still there? Oh, I guess we dropped out for a second. There you are. I lost you for a minute there. No, that's good. So married 29 years in August?
Yes, 29 years in August. So, still happy. So.
Yeah. What's the date? August what?
August 24th.
All right.
August 24th.
I had to put you on the spot there, right? You had to get that answer right on national radio here, because that's a big question. You got to know the answer to that one.
Oh, what was that, Mike?
I said you need to know the answer to that one. That's a big question.
I
put you on the spot on
national
radio.
You know what helped me was we had napkins for a couple of that. We had leftover napkins that had the date on there, and that helped me the first couple of years. To remember, I will say that I shouldn't tell my wife that, but that's how I remembered the first couple of years, and then it stuck in my memory. So,
Talking with trainer Brian Williamson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Brian, you talk about marrying into that Veneer family, and when you hear the name Veneer, especially in Illinois in the Chicago area, that is a name that is revered, and it has been for many, many years. Harvey Veneer, I had the privilege to meet him when I was working at Keeneland when I first got into the industry, and one of the nicest people you were ever going to meet, and one heck of a horse trainer.
Yes, he was something else. He was like the hardest working man I've ever known. He was just like from, you know, sunrise. He just work. I mean, all day long, and he could chew a horse. He could, you know, used to gallop and ride, and I think he was a jockey for a little while. And good horse, good leg man. Learned a lot from him. He was a real good horseman.
Yeah, he won the leading trainer title at Arlington 8 times. 5 of those were in consecutive years. And then also won the training title at Keeneland, if I recall, and won the Bluegrass Stakes a couple of times too.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, yeah. He had some Illinois breds that could win at Keeneland and or anywhere. And he was a big part of his wife Nancy, my mother-in-law. They were big breeders in Illinois, and she was good at picking out the studs and everything else. And Harvey was good at training them, and it worked out good. They had a lot of success, and when you went into their house, they had trophies and pictures all over the place from a lot of big wins and stuff.
What things did you take away from your father-in-law that you still use in your operation today?
Just kind of mostly leg stuff. Painting, you know, you paint the horse's legs with a different solution, and just stuff like that. A lot of leg stuff that he did, I still do. And then he was pretty old school about training him. He trained him hard and stuff, and and I try to train as hard as I can up to a point, and because it seems to, he had a lot of success, and I look at that and try to duplicate that.
We always hear that horses have changed over the years, and maybe they're not as durable as they once were back in the old days, per se. Do you feel that way too, Brian? Do you have to train them a little bit differently today than your father-in-law had to, say, 40, 50 years ago?
Yeah, I think in a way. Now you have the synthetic tracks now, which I've been stable at a poly track before, and that took some time to get used to. It's like it's not the same, and it'll you'll have different injuries on that versus a dirt track, and I think, you know, we've always had good luck giving a horse a break, like but we've had a farm where we could do that, and if you give them a break when they need time, they'll tell you, and that's kind of what we always did, and we've had horses go on for years, you know, and keep running, you know, campaign after campaign, if you just give them a little break when they need it. Yeah,
it seems to be the key, you know, and it's like that for any athlete, right? You'll see, you know, athletes obviously have an off season, and horses don't necessarily have that unless you give them a break and turn them out. And luckily, you've been fortunate enough to be able to do that.
Exactly. They'll, you know, some stuff you can work them through and they'll get over it. And then some stuff they, you know, and if it keeps happening if you have stuff on top of stuff happen, you know, you're going to have to give them the time when they need it. You're going to have to give them that time, and they'll usually come back, you know, real good.
So. Well, Brian, it's not just about you. Your operation involves your family, too. You're very family-oriented, and not just your wife, who, as I mentioned, is a veneer, but your sons are also involved, too, right?
Yes, they're working... they're working for us. The whole family's working, and I got a few horses at Keeneland right now, and then I got some at Churchill, and one of them's over at Keeneland, and one of them's at Churchill right now, and so yeah, it's pretty much a family operation.
What did they do? How do they help you? What's their role?
Well, my oldest son, he's assistant trainer. He just got his assistant's license recently, but he's still learning, and he's just helped me and being around the barn. And if something happens, or if I got to send a groom to go to Ellis or do something, he'll, you know, take over there, you know, do whatever needs to be done. So he's basically, you know, set feed to and just keep an eye on stuff and just do kind of what needs to be done. Pick up the slack, so to speak.
Yeah. Did you always encourage them to get involved in racing, or did you try to maybe steer them in a different direction?
Yeah, I tried to steer them in a different direction with college and stuff. And my oldest went a couple years, but he wanted to come back to the racetrack, and my other one, he pretty much wanted to just come to the racetrack right away after high school. So we tried to, like, you know, we said, hey, you know, we'll pay for the college if you go, and but they liked the racetrack. So,
well, you can relate to that story because it's very similar to what you went through as
a
young man.
Yeah, so very much.
Yeah, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, I guess. How neat is it to be able to do this alongside your sons? How cool is that to be able to have them by your side for the, you know, the highs and the lows?
Yes, yeah, especially the highs. The lows, I don't know, but no, I'm just kidding. But sometimes it could be a little rough. If the highs are high. And there's nothing like winning a race. There's that feeling, and just everybody, it just pumps everybody up. So it's good. It's good that they're right with us.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter what kind of race you win. Claiming race, stakes race, obviously they're all very special in their own way, but just that thrill of winning a race is so special.
Oh, yes. Yeah, isn't that the truth? I mean, it's unbelievable when you win a race. Everybody just lights up and just changes their whole attitude and really picks up the barn and everything. When you go through a little slump when you're not winning, that's you really cherish when you do win. You know, it's a great feeling.
What's the best part about training racehorses for a living, Brian?
There's a certain amount of satisfaction when you could train them. You know, when you get them to win and beat the competition, beat some of the big trainers or some big horse or something like that. It's there's something about that that's very satisfying. I had one real nice mare, Streamline, and we trained. We trained a stallion, we trained the mare, and then we trained her, and she went a couple graded stakes, and it's so satisfying to go from there and to breed them to do all that with that and be, you know, compete on that level. That it's just a great feeling.
Yeah, that story involving Streamline is a great story, and you led me right into it. We're going to come back after this short commercial break, and we're going to talk more about Streamline. I'll let you tell me the whole story, because I think people will really enjoy it. We'll talk about the stallion too, Straight Line, and the relationship there. Should be pretty good, and we'll do that when we come back. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're gonna have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
Hello, I'm Michael Blowen, founder of Old Friends Thoroughbred Retirement Farm. One of our highest priorities for these living legends is safety. That's why the fence we trust most at Old Friends is the V-Mesh Keepsake from Red Brand. Keepsake features a V-Mesh weave to prevent hooves from getting caught, and the mesh design flexes on impact. Learn more about the quality, safety, and long-lasting value of Keepsake V-Mesh Horse Fence by visiting redbrand.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Wide open at the top of the stretch, Streamline has the lead. Power of Snunner splits horses. And also in the center of the track, it's Eskin for Money. Still, Streamline is the leader. She's a length and a half in front of Eskin for Money in second. Terra Promessa, no better than third. Streamline leads. Eskin for Money to the outside in Tiger Moth. It is Streamline to win the Azeri. Streamline won by a length over Eskin for Money. Tiger Moth third, Power of Snunner fourth.
Fixed offer with the call of the Grade 2 Azzeri. That was in 2017. Streamline, one of a couple of greatest stakes victories for her. She was super talented and trained by my special guest on Trainer Talk today, Brian Williamson. We'll continue that visit in just a second, right after I remind you that if you did miss any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, all you have to do, you know the drill. You head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can listen to this show and to all of our shows at your leisure. They're all there for you, all the way back to our very first one that we did about 8 years ago. You can go back and flip through and binge listen, if you will, to all these Trainer Talk shows at horseracingradio.net. Well, yeah, that moment when Streamline crossed the finish line at Oaklawn, and again, Vic Stauffer had the call. That moment was so special for so many reasons for Brian and for his family. And Brian, I had to take you on a little trip down memory lane there with that stretch call.
Yeah, that was music to my ears, that's for sure.
Take me back to that day. Tell me about that moment. I said it was special. Why was it so special?
Special. My mother-in-law was there, my two sons, my wife, everybody involved. It was we were all there, and it was just such an awesome day. That was just you can't describe the feeling almost unless you've been there. Really, it's like something just magical.
Yeah, we touched on it before we went to the commercial break. Streamline was special because of the fact that she was a daughter of Straight Line, and that stallion was purchased back in 2003 by your wife and her mother, Nancy, at the Keeneland September sale, and turned out to be a really nice racehorse.
Yes. My mother-in-law and Bill Cartwright of Cartwright Thoroughbred, they picked out the horse in the sale, Straight Line. And we kept that partnership, Nancy and Cartwright, and we went through the straight line deal, and it was great. And then Cartwright is also in on with Streamline. He stayed in, and everything was, so it was the same partnership from the stallion on through to Streamline, which was fun. And they're great people, Bill Cartwright and Mike Manini and Andy Suave, and so that was all good. And it was just we got a good partnership with them, and it was just a fun day that day.
Tell me a little bit more about Streamline. Just that win in the Azzeri that we talked about was a day that you're never going to forget, but there were other highlights in her career too.
Yes. She came to me as a two-year-old at Arlington, and she worked a few times, and then something was going on in her rear end, we couldn't quite figure it out, but something was going on. So we gave her some time. She came back as a three-year-old and was breezing really good, and so her mom had won a stake on the turf, an Illinois bred stake, so we were thinking she was probably a turf horse. So I run her on the turf a couple times, and I think her first race was on the Poly, and she won. And then I was trying to get her on the turf after that because of the mother. And she ran, and she went on the turf, but it wasn't like a real impressive. And then, so right before we were going to go to Oaklawn, I said, well, I'm going to run her on the dirt and see if she likes it. If she doesn't, I won't bring her to Oaklawn. Well, I run her an allowance race, and she wins by like 15, and just like never asked her. And I was like, holy cow. So I brought her to Oaklawn and run her into Pippin, because there was no other runner in the allowance race, but there wasn't any. So I run her in the stake, and she won that. And I was like, it was dirt it was dirt from then on out. I mean, you know, she loved the dirt. Yeah, she had great numbers, and that was just a fantastic ride we went on with her. And we went 3 years in a row. We went through the same Pippin as Aries, and then ended up in Apple Blossom, and that was the pinnacle of it. Was the Apple Blossom, the Grade One, and it was just fun 3 years in a row that she was competitive, and I think she was third the 1 year. I can't remember now, but the first time. But it was just three years of just having a fun time with her. It was awesome.
Yeah, she was second in the 2016 Apple Blossom. The next year she came back and was third, and then she was fourth
That's
in 2018.
Right. Yeah.
But just think about that. I mean, she started her career in, 2015? She raced until the end of the 2018 season. She was tough, too.
Yes. Yes, that's she was pretty durable. We'd give her a break every year, a little break, and luckily we didn't have any major problems or anything. I mean, just normal stuff, you know, maybe a puffy ankle here and there or something like that. But then you work on it and tighten it down, but never went off or anything like that. So it was just when she was a two-year-old that she had that back end problem, and that was basically the only time she ever had any issue, really. The rest of the time we just gave her a break because she ran hard.
Yeah.
And so she was a very durable horse.
Is there something special, Brian, about – we talked about it at the top of the show. You're a native of Chicago and Streamline, an Illinois bred. You've trained many Illinois breds over the years, but you get one of this caliber. Is there something special for you about walking into the paddock for a big race like that with an Illinois bred? Does it make it a little more special?
Yes, it did. It felt like we were the underdog, and then when she'd perform like she did, she just it just make you so proud. I mean, we couldn't have been prouder of her, you know, running, competing at that level. And just, you know, with a backyard bred, so to speak, horse, you know, to compete at that level was just awesome.
Yeah, from start to finish, Streamline was in the Veneer family and the Williamson family now too, which is pretty cool. It's a wonderful story. Tell me about a couple other horses that, when you think back on your career, that you're always going to remember, Brian.
Well, for sure, the straight line, the same stream line we ran. I know we ran in the Ohio Derby with him, and I think we were like kind of third choice, but he ran like fifth that day or something like that. He didn't quite, but he gave us some thrills along the way. He won some races, and I think he tied a track record at Turfway, so he ran good on the dirt and the poly. And there's some other ones, like at Harvey, when I wasn't exactly a trainer, but I was pretty much the guy that was in charge of him, like Hammacher. We had a horse, Hammacher, who's just a solid Illinois sprinter, and he was one of my favorites. And then we had a horse that my mother-in-law and my wife and I owned, Beret. She won a couple little stakes. And then, one of my favorites was Wade For Me was her name, and she won the Modesty. And then we run in Beverly D, and I think she was like sixth or seventh, but only got beat a few lengths, not very far. But that was a thrill too, to run in the Beverly D after winning the Modesty with her. She was one of my favorite horses.
Yeah, really special. How many horses do you have in training now, Brian?
I got about 20. I got 16 at Churchill and 4 over there at Keeneland. And I had 16 stalls at Churchill for the meet. And then I got some stalls at Keeneland for the overflow. So I got some over there, which is good because we're running right now and over there.
Is that the right number for you, or would you like to have a few more?
Last few years, I've been like about 30 or something like that. But it's hard breaking into a new track like Churchill. They gave me 16, and I probably could have used. I could have filled up 25, but I had to take what I can get. I'm the kid on the block, so I just you just kind of do what you have to do, and so I got a few more stalls at Keeneland for that. For the past month and a half or something, I've been there. So.
Yeah, one of the things we talked about earlier, and you think that it could be a key to keeping horses around longer, is being able to give them a break. So when you turn them out and take them away from the racetrack, what do you do with them?
We have a farm in Versailles. It's 230 acres, and it's beautiful. It's hills and nice pastures, and we turn them out there and let them be a horse for a while. And before that, we had a farm in Illinois that we sold a few years ago and bought a farm in Versailles. We decided to move our operation to Kentucky. We do the same thing there. That we had a big farm there that we just turn them out in. But it seems like we bought this farm a few years ago in Versailles, and we actually have two farms. We got one with the brood mares, and then they'll foal at the smaller farm, and then once we wean them, they go to the bigger farm. And they're coming in big and strong and full. They got muscle on top of muscle. They look great. So we're real happy with the way everything's going there. They're getting that bluegrass here and coming in just big and strong and look great. So.
That has to be a nice little advantage, or at least a nice little perk, to be able to run your program the way you want it to run, both on and off the racetrack.
Yes. Yeah. It's nice to have it. It's tough though. It's a lot of stuff. There's, it just seems like, something will hit you at every time, if it's not something, it's another. If it's not the help, it's the horse. If it's not the horse, it's the. I mean, it's tough sometimes, but everybody goes through it. But it is nice to have, to know you can like give them, we got a farm, we could turn them out and stuff like that. So it's great to have that.
Brian, what would you say is your greatest training feat to date?
Oh, wow. I guess it would have to be just campaigning streamline. I would say we just missed. We were just under, I think she was like 936. She just was under a million. I was trying that last little part to maybe hope. I knew she only had a few races. Before we were going to retire, we weren't going to go another year. We wanted to breed her, and she had run hard for a few years. So I was hoping that we could, make it to a million, but we didn't quite get there. But there's no shame in that. I'll tell you that she was golden for us.
Yeah, 922,000 was the total for Streamline when she finally retired. And and it that has to be, you know, that's probably one of those things that is difficult for a trainer, because you want to get to that million-dollar mark if you can, and especially with a filly that's so talented like she was and became even more so as a mare. That's got to stick with you a little bit, huh, that you can't quite get her there.
I was trying, and I knew I had she had run good right at the end, but I knew we had a plan. We were going to make sure she had enough time before breeding season to kind of let down and everything. So we kind of had that plan, so we didn't want to go too far, and I knew it, and we just came up a little short, but that's okay. She retired healthy and everything else, so that's all good. Yeah.
Talking with trainer Brian Williamson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Brian, let me throw another name at you, and you can tell me her story. Latia.
Oh, yes, Latia. Yeah, that brings back some memories. I hired an assistant. I knew a guy in Chicago, a Spanish guy, Armando de la Cerda. And I hired him as my assistant, he knew a bunch of other Spanish guys or Mexicans, and there was one owner. He owned some taco shops in Chicago, there, Salvador, he gave me some horses to train. And I think it was because Armando, he knew Armando, and so I got the horses, and she ended up winning. Was it the Oaks at Arlington? Or she won the 3-year-old race over there, and she was a nice filly, and it had a lot of good times. She could run, At the beginning of the next year, my assistant was going out on his own, or he got Latia then, and he's doing real good down there. He's a great guy, Armando. He's down in Florida right now, and he's doing real good. And he got her. I was just going into a story. I don't know if about something, but he got her then the next year, which was fine. I knew I got the horse because he was working for me, and he was ready to go on his own. He's a great guy and a good trainer. And I remember I had a filly named Kepi in the next year against Latia, and I wasn't training Latia, but I was training Kepi, and we're on the grass, in a stake at Arlington, an Illinois bred race. And it rained when we were in the paddock. It rained. The heavens opened up in the sky, and it rained. And they take it off the turf, which I was, like, favored on the turf, but Latia would have been favored on the poly because she had won, you know, some races on the poly. Yeah. And I didn't think I had any shot. And wouldn't you know, Kepi come down the stretch and just blew past Latia. And it was one of the best memories. I was just bringing it up because it was a memory, just because, even though, you know, I had that horse Latia the year before. And then to beat her on that, it was kind of fun that day.
Oh, that's so special. Yeah, that's, you know, people don't, when they look at horse trainers from the outside looking in, and they're not involved in the sport, when you have a horse like Latia that you trained and she was so good to you, and then you end up losing her, but you compete against her, to be able to turn the tables, it that means a lot to a trainer, yeah. Doesn't it?
Yes. That was one of my funnest memories was that. Me and Armando and we're good friends and everything. We still talk to each other and stuff like that. But it was just like a friendly rivalry, so to speak. And that was a fun day that day. And I still talk to the the owner Salvador and stuff, and he and everything's good. You know, business is business, and I understand. And but I did, you know, I did good with her. I think I win like 4 out of 6 with her or something. And then, you know, when I didn't train her, it was just like a fun type rivalry.
Yeah,
good memory.
If you could spend the day with one trainer, Brian, it could be any trainer, past or present, if you had the opportunity to spend the day with one person and watch their operation, learn from them, and pick their brain, who would it be?
I would say there's probably one or two, either Charlie Whittingham or Woody Stevens. One of those two. I would really love to hear what they're thinking and what they think about doing with leg problems and stuff like that. That would interest me. Yeah,
kind of like your father-in-law, Harvey Veneer. They're old school horsemen, and there are some wonderful trainers today in this sport. But there's something about that generation of trainers that's just a little bit different, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that. It seems like now the trainers are more they're more promotion than like hands on. Where Harvey and them, they're all hands on and now it seems like you got to talk good and talk good over the phone and be a good promoter. That's what it seems like to me a little bit. Yeah,
I think so too. And a lot of it has come down to percentages now, right? Where an owner, especially a new owner in the game, even established owners, will look through a trainer's resume and just look at the win percentage and say, this is the person I want to go with, as opposed to, you know, looking at the whole picture and seeing a trainer that, you know, likes to spend time with the horses and maybe isn't a big operation, but they do things a little bit differently and they're there every day. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it seems like a lot of the programs today are based on numbers.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It has become like a percentage type thing, and it's hard to, you know, some of the guys, some of the trainers don't get the best stock. And I wish the owners would look at it and what a trainer gets and what they, you know, what they have and what they accomplish, you know, instead of, you know, some of these super trainers get so many horses that they got the best bred and the best of everything and the highest price sales horses. And it's not necessarily a hands-on thing. It's kind of, doesn't seem fair in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you still attend the sales often, Brian, and you look for some new talent, so to speak?
Yes. I've been going to like the Keeneland sale and stuff and trying to get a little influx of new blood here and there, and that always helps, especially if you got some owners that are looking for something new, exciting. You know, it's fun, you know, to kind of go and see them and check out their legs and there's something about that is kind of fun and it gets that excitement going that you know you always have dreams for them, you know. That's you're always looking for the next big horse, for sure.
Brian Williamson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Brian, down to our final about 2.5 minutes or so. The hour has really gone by quickly. I always like to end the show by asking trainers to tell me a little something about them that people might not know. So we talked about your love of the Chicago White Sox and the Chicago Bears, being from Chicago, but are there any other hobbies or things you enjoy doing when you do get a chance to be away from the racetrack a little bit?
Yeah, it seems like I'm one of these people that, like, for a while there, I was, like, reading every cookbook I can get and was getting into cooking for a few years. Then I went through a phase where I was doing watercolor paintings, and I did that for, and I produced a bunch of those, and it seems like I'm one of them guys that, like, kind of goes through something and then, like, focuses on the next, and I kind of go through my hobbies sort of like that. Right now I'm running around from racetrack to racetrack, it seems like, but I'm just glad we're running with all the stuff that's going on right now.
We talked about some of your favorite racehorses. Quickly before we wrap things up, what's your favorite painting that you've ever created?
You know, I did a painting of my two sons on the beach in Florida, and my wife loved it too, and she had it framed in a nice frame, and that's my favorite one. If I have to say myself, it looks pretty good for being somebody who hasn't painted all that much. But I think it looks pretty good.
Well, he's trainer Brian Williamson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Brian, it has been a delight to hear your story and kind of take a trip down memory lane with you. Really appreciate the visit and all the best moving forward, my friend.
Well, thank you, Mike, and it was fun to go back down memory lane with you, and I'm looking forward to meeting you in the near future.
So. Yeah, definitely. Go win some races.
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. He's Brian Williamson. I'm Mike Penna, and this has been Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Now for my producer, Lee Della Pina, in our Lexington studios. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a lovely evening.